So we're going to look at chapter 8, verses 1 through 29. Last time we left Joshua, was it a good note that we know we were all kind of a little sad by what happened? Not a real good note to end on. Joshua had suffered experiencing God's anger. God's presence left Israel, their army, and Joshua to themselves, and they experienced a tragedy. They experienced a defeat. And even though Joshua took care of that, they dealt with the sin and began to restore that relationship, and God's anger turned away from Israel, that defeat can linger. You ever experience failure in your life? Sin causing God to discipline you? How do you feel afterwards? Probably not so great. Joshua probably feels this failure more than others because he's their leader. Leaders experience and take the weight of a defeat or a failure a lot greater than other people do at times. And that's what we're kind of going to be looking at today. We're going to look at moving beyond this defeat. Gentleman says failure takes on a life of their own. Failures take on a life of their own because the brain remembers incomplete tasks or failures longer than any success or completed activity. I didn't realize that. It's technically referred to as the Zeigarnik effect. When a project or a thought is completed, the brain places it in a special memory. It no longer gives the project priority or active working status. Some women in here are like, yeah, I wish my husband had that problem, right? They're like, no, there's no nothing there. But failures have no closure. The brain continues to spin the memory, trying to come up with ways to fix the mess and move it from active to inactive status. Interesting. Even though Joshua didn't sin, there was a defeat. Joshua experienced that defeat up close and personal, and he's probably still lingering on in the back of his head. He had to stop all forward progress, deal with God's anger by punishing an entire family. Joshua had a really bad week, do you think? That defeat is probably still lingering in that back of his mind. He wants to get beyond that. How often have we experienced similar situations? Broken fellowship with God because of sin. We suffer loss and we repent. We deal with the sin. But what do we do after that? How do we move beyond that defeat? The better question is how does God move us beyond that defeat? And that is exactly what we are going to see here today. God moving Joshua and Israel beyond that defeat at the hands of Ai. And I see three aspects to how God does that. The first aspect is he restores us to his purposes. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 2. Now the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise, go up to Ai and see. I have given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king just as you did to Jericho and its king. You shall take only its spoil and its cattle as plunder for yourselves. Set an ambush for the city behind it. I'm saying I differently this week. Do you guys notice that? I said AI, and I think that was wrong. So I'm just going to correct that. So you see here that God initiates this conversation with Joshua. For nearly 100 years, there was a beautiful mural of Jesus, and it held a pride place in the sanctuary of Mercy Church in Bora, Spain. The Ecce Homo, or Behold the Man's style of painting, was completed by Elias Garcia Martinez in the 1930s. But in August 2012, an 80-year-old church member named Cecilia Gimenez took it upon herself to touch it up a bit. She was right about one thing. The painting needed some work. After decades of moisture buildup, the painting had started to deteriorate, and the colors had started to fade. So Cecilia initiated her do-it-yourself restoration project. Yeah, despite her good intentions, the painting didn't turn out so well. The New York Times said it was probably the worst art restoration project of all time. A Spanish blog called it the restoration that turned into destruction. And the BBC article said that delicate brushstrokes by Martinez had been buried under a haphazard splattering of paint. The once dignified portrait of Jesus now resembles a crown sketch of a hairy monkey in an ill-fitted tunic. In later interviews, she defended her actions, claiming that, and blamed her parish priest, claiming that he had initiated the project. But on occasions, she took responsibility for her attempt to fix the painting, saying, "We've always fixed everything ourselves in this church." There is a restoration that needs to take place. The artwork has been blemished, but that is not up for us to do, is it? We are going to end up like our little friend here if we attempt the restoration project. So we need to let God do the restoring. God is in the business of bringing back to life that which has suffered some blemishes, and that is what he is about to do with Joshua and with Israel. He is going to begin to restore them, and he begins by restoring them to his purposes. Think about the last time God and Joshua had an interaction. What is God saying to Joshua in that last interaction? Joshua's down on his face. Remember this? And God's like, "Get up. What are you doing? And deal with this sin at hand." That's not a pleasant memory for Joshua. But look at the difference here. God comes to Joshua, and we do not want to overlook this. And he speaks to him. And he speaks to him in a very gentle and compassionate way. "Do not fear or be dismayed. Rise up." Last time he told Joshua to rise up, it was to deal with sin. This time he's telling him to rise up, and he's putting him right back where he left him off at. Right back on mission with God. And here we see a side of God in the Old Testament that people tend to forget. We're familiar with his wrath. We're familiar with his judgment. We're familiar with his holiness. But look at this side of God. He's gentle. He's compassionate. And he is ministering to Joshua as a person. That's how he begins restoring him to his purposes, is he restores the person first. "Do not fear or be dismayed." He's saying the same thing that he started out the narrative with. "Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened. Do not be dismayed." He's bringing Joshua back to that original commission, reminding him that everything is going to be okay. God knows exactly what we need to hear and when we need to hear it. He knows that Joshua is probably a little fearful. Joshua's probably like, "How on earth do I continue on? I just saw God wipe out an entire family. I was a little fearful. I'm afraid of messing up. I'm afraid of continuing." He's discouraged because he had connections with that family. These were his people he had to kill. And God says, "Do not fear." He knows exactly what we need to hear. And I sometimes think I know what I need to hear at times, right? You know, I could be, many times I'm wallowing in my self-pity and I'm like, "Woe is me, I messed up," or "Woe is me, I can't do it anymore." And what do I want God to do? I want God to join in my little wallowing party, don't I? I want him to come alongside and be like, "It's okay, baby, don't worry. You're going to be just fine. But what does he do? And then I'll read a verse like, you have not struggled to the point of blood against your sin. And I'm like, whoa, all right. And what does it do? It snaps me out of it. Why? Because that's exactly what I needed to hear. And sometimes I'm hard on myself. And I'm like, I'm an utter failure. I can't, you know, I'm a jerk. I'm an idiot. And then God says to me, a bruised reed he will not break and a smoldering wick he will not put out. God knows exactly what we need to hear. He tailors the reassurance to meet our present need. This is exactly what Joshua needed to hear. The passage that we're looking at today is this restoration, is bringing them, moving them beyond this defeat. And it begins with Joshua as a leader. We have to see how God interacts with his leaders, especially after they suffered this tragedy. God is ready for Joshua and Israel to what? Move forward, to move beyond that defeat. He puts them, listen to what he says. I'm going to give to you the king of Ai, just like what? Jericho. Before this whole mess even happened, he's bringing him back to where he left off. Just like Jericho, you are going to have a victory. He reassures his person. He's ministering to his emotion. He reaffirms his promise. And there's a bonus. He gives an added provision. Do we read what he said here? You can take the spoil. You can take the cattle. Wow. And our hearts are aching for Achan. Why? Only if he had waited. Only if he had waited, he would have gotten what he had taken. But he didn't wait. Look at how God begins working in the heart and the life of Joshua here. Reassuring him as a person. Reaffirming his promise and adding in a little extra provision. That's amazing. God knows what they have just experienced. God knows it was hard. And this is how he begins to move them beyond that defeat. The second aspect that I see here is he redeems the defeat. He redeems the defeat. And this is a long section, so bear with me as I read through it. Verses 3 through 17. So Joshua, with all the people of war, so Joshua rose with all the people of war to go up to Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 men, valiant warriors, and sent them out at night. He commanded them, saying, see, you are going to ambush the city from behind it. Do not go very far from the city, but all of you be ready. Then I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. And when they come out to meet us, as at first, we will flee before them. Then they will come after us until we have drawn them away from the city, for they will say, they are fleeing before us as at first. So we will flee before them. And you shall rise from your ambush and take possession of the city, for the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. Then it will be when you have seized the city that you shall set the city on fire. You shall do it according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you. So Joshua sent them away. And they went to the place of ambush and remained between Bethel and Ai and the west side of Ai. But Joshua spent the night among the people. He rose early in the morning and mustered the people. He went out with the elders. Now the plan is being carried out. So that was the plan, and now the plan is being carried out. He went out with the elders of Israel before the people of Ai. Then all the people of war who were with him went up and drew near and arrived in the front of the city. And they camped on the north side of Ai. Now there was a valley between him and Ai. He took about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. So they stationed the people, all the army that was on the north side of the city, its rear guard on the west side of the city, and Joshua spent the night in the midst of the valley. It came about when the king of Ai saw it, the men of the city hurried and rose up early and went out to meet Israel in battle, he and all his people at the appointed place before the desert plain. But he did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. Joshua and Israel all pretended to be beaten before them and fled away by way of the wilderness. And all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them. They pursued Joshua and were drawn away from the city. So not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who had not gone out after Israel. And they left the city unguarded and pursued Israel. In her article, Soaring Journeys, Jill Caratini relates that on March 1, 1999, Bertrand Picard and Brian Jones stepped into the gondola of a hot air balloon and lifted off from the Swiss Alpine village of the Chateau de Haut. 19 days, 21 hours, and 55 minutes later, traveling 28,431 miles, they landed in the Egyptian desert. Their journey successfully marked the first nonstop flight around the world in a balloon, earning them the distinction of a world record, a book deal, and millions of dollars from a sponsoring corporation. Their victory photograph now rests in the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum behind the Breitling Orbiter 3 itself. That's the balloon. But like almost any significant life journey, she says, like spiritual growth, the journey of the Orbiter 3 didn't take an easy or straight line. As its name suggests, the Orbiter 3 was built upon two previous attempts. In fact, the journey that would end with a world record actually had three hopeful starting points and two frustrated finishes. The original Orbiter launched in 1997, only a few hours after takeoff. The balloon was forced to land when the crew was overcome by kerosene fumes from a leaking valve. 1 year later, the Orbiter 2 stayed in the air 9 days longer than its counterpart, but their flight was cut short when they were refused permission to enter into China airspace. However, both of these setbacks actually contributed to the strategy that would allow Picard and Jones to finally pilot their balloon across the Pacific. The setbacks, you notice that? The setbacks, the failures, contributed to the strategy of the success. That is exactly what God does here. He redeems their defeat. The whole plan is based upon the fact that they fled from Ai previously. The whole plan is based on their defeat. The victory that is going to be achieved is because God incorporates their defeat into that strategy. That's amazing. But that is exactly what God is in the business of doing. We can get by our defeats and we can learn from them and we can learn lessons from them, but we never sometimes think of those defeats that God is going to use, that which we deem as a failure, to actually bring us success. But that's what he does here. The whole plan is based on the fact that they ran away. That's what he says. He says, they will see us fleeing as we did before. God is in the business of redemption. And we see that this is God's plan from start to finish. This is why God needs to do the restoring. God can see it all. He can take our mistakes, he can take our flaws, he can take our defeats, and he can put them and weave them into his plans for his victories. And that's exactly what he does here. And we don't always see that in our lives. It's like a big tapestry, and God is weaving all of these, taking all of these threads, and from the back it looks like a jumble mess, but flip it over and it's a beautiful carpet. So we see that when God said to Joshua in verse 2, set an ambush, that's not really helpful, is it? Set an ambush, but we know that there was more to that ambush. This is God's plan. This is God's strategy. God tells Joshua exactly how to redeem that defeat. He maps it out completely. But Joshua still needs to be obedient to it. And that's why it is so important that we give our defeats, we give our failures, we give all of these things into God's hands and let Him work out the plan to use them for His success. And it's different. We see a very different strategy from that of Jericho. God doesn't always operate in the same way. You want us to what? You want us to run? Oh, that's going to look bad. Why are we running? We just ran last time. They need to see us be strong. Oh, no. I'm redeeming that defeat. And sometimes it looks to the world like we are in retreat, but we are actually moving forward. And we see that God uses different strategies at different times. And we need to be obedient. Do all that is according to the word of the Lord. They have to follow this plan to a T. And not only does God's strategy include His purposes for His people, but it includes the world. In those strategies, God brings I to where He wants them to be. And He does the same with us, and He uses our defeats in order to do that. And I know that this section can get somewhat confusing with all the numbers, but thankfully, we have this really technical map to help us out here. This took me laughing at. This took me about a week to do. What a slaving. You know how hard this geography is? This is to scale, people. Let me just give you a little key to the map in case you don't know. That red stuff and the orange, that's fire. Because Jericho's on fire, Ai's on fire. The blue stuff, that's water. That's the Jordan River right there. So just to give you a little heads up. But I know it gets confusing, so we're going to look at this map. It's a little strategy of what happened here. But we got to see that this is God's strategy. God has it all mapped out. They have to follow this plan to a T. So we have a number, 30,000 people. So commentators are going to disagree on this. So if you go to a commentator, you might find something different. But I got this off of YouTube, so you know that this is accurate. Anyway, you got 30,000 people. So 25,000 people, they were at Jericho. 25 are going to go up to the north of Ai. And there's a ravine in between the 25,000 and Ai. So that way, if Ai saw them at night and they came out, there would be a ravine to protect them. Joshua sends 5,000 from that 30,000 around to the west of Ai and in between Ai and Bethel. And they station there. The other dotted line from the 25,000 might have been another ambush party, but we are not certain. So the whole strategy is based on Joshua fleeing before Ai. So they have to come out in front of Ai, so they do that in the morning. It says to the appointed place, the desert plains, which was a place of battle. There was a battlefield there. So they came out. Ai sees them, and Ai does what? Woof! Right out after them. And then the ambush goes in, and the whole plan works because of their previous defeat. Because they will say what? They are fleeing before us like they did the first time. That is amazing. God has this map in His head. Not this one. He's a much better map than that. But He knows how to take that which we seem as a failure, that which we thought might have hindered us in the future. Do you think Joshua thought that defeat was going to help them? Absolutely not. They were worried because they thought that Ai and the rest of the people were going to think they were cowards and come out after them. But here, He takes that which He thought was going to be an obstacle and makes it an opportunity. Chuck Colson went to prison. Everyone knows Chuck Colson. Why did he go to prison? He went to prison for the Watergate scandal. That's not a little mishap. Everyone knows about Watergate, right? Nixon, Watergate. But before he went to prison, what happened to Chuck? He became a Christian. And he says this. He says that out of everything that God has used the most, his success came from the time that he has spent. Where? In prison. What does he have? Chuck Colson's prison ministries. That's what God is in the business of doing. My biggest problem, believe it or not, growing up in school was talking. I'm not sure if you would ever believe that, but I was a little talker, just talking all the time. My parents didn't know what to do with me. My mom said I had ants in my pants. I just kept, and they came out of my mouth. And I just kept talking all the time. All the time on my report cards, talking, 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 talking. What does God do with a person like that? Well, here we go. Huh? You don't think that the things that we used to get us in trouble, the things that were our flaws, the things that caused our failures, God can flip them around. That's what he is in the business of doing. That's redemption. Taking all our faults, taking all of our failures, taking our defeats, and using them in his plan. You imagine how encouraged Joshua and Israel are right now. Oh, God, that's a really good idea. I like that idea. Encouraged. Moving them beyond that defeat, not just forgetting about it, but actually using it in his victory. Plan works. They all flee the city. And it brings us to our last and final aspect. How God moves us beyond that, he reveals his presence. Verses 18 through 29. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand." So Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city. The men in ambush rose quickly from their place, and when he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it. And they quickly set its city on fire. When the men of Ai turned and back and looked, behold, the smoke of the city ascended to the sky. And they had no place to flee. Who has no place to flee? Ai does. This way or that. For the people who had been fleeing to the wilderness then turned against their pursuers. When Joshua and all Israel saw that the men in ambush had captured the city and the smoke of the city ascended, they turned back and slew the men of Ai. The others came out from the city to encounter them so that they were trapped in the midst of Israel. Some on this side and some on that side, and they slew them until there was no one left of those who survived or escaped. But they took alive the king of Ai and brought him to Joshua. Now when Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the field in the wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them were fallen by the edge of the sword until they were destroyed, then all Israel returned to Ai and struck it with the edge of the sword. All who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not withdraw his hand from which he stretched out the javelin until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of the city as plunder for themselves, according to the word of the Lord which he had commanded Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a heap forever, a desolation until this day. He hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening. And at sunset, Joshua gave the command. They took his body down from the tree. They threw it in the entrance of the city, raised it over a great heap of stones that stands to this day. Guy tells a story about working on a driveway with his son, Jordan. And they were using a chisel and a hammer to remove old asphalt and patching it with new asphalt. They were both tired, so their accuracy was declining, and at one point the son hammered his finger. He jumped up in agony, holding back the tears as he ran for ice into the house. And the father realized that he was running into an empty house and no one was there, so he went inside with him. And when he came inside, he heard him screaming in agony and pain, and he tried to get him and encourage him to put his finger in a bowl of ice, but the son didn't want to do it because it stung too much. So he eventually got him to put it in the ice, and he got him to do it by putting his own hand in the ice with him. And there they sat on the cold kitchen floor with both of their hands in ice water. Occasionally, they would take them out to let the feeling return, and after 10 minutes, he calmed down and started to feel a little bit better. With tears drying in his eyes, he looked at the father and said, "I'm glad you are here." He said, "I was reminded that as a pastor or a father, my presence can sometimes help ease the pain. It won't always take it away, but it can ease the pain." Joshua, the last time he went in battle, so now this is the climax of the battle. Joshua has to turn and fight. What happened the last time Joshua fought? He got beat. He smacked his finger with a hammer, and there was no one there to ease that pain. What do we see that God does here in the midst of the battle, right when Joshua could be getting nervous, when everything is heating up? He's got to turn back now, and he's got to fight against the king who previously defeated him. God comes alongside of him. And what does he say? Well, first he comes alongside of him and he reveals that he is with him. That is what caused the defeat last time, is that God was not what? With them. Joshua remembers that, and he possibly still feels the sting of that. But God comes alongside Joshua and says, "Hey, I'm with you, and you're going to watch me work." He encourages him with his presence. The whole defeat last time was because God's anger was manifested in his departure. Joshua saw up close and personally what was the result of such abandonment. Here, when things are about to heat up, God speaks to Joshua. He comes alongside of him. He encourages him with his presence, the very thing Joshua needed to know. And sometimes when we're moving forward, and maybe we've repented and we've dealt with things and we're moving forward, but we're a little timid, sometimes doesn't God come alongside us and encourage us in special ways, revealing to us that he is here, letting us know that he is going to fight those battles for us? Once again, we see that Joshua is being reassured and God is about to show him a victory. He's about to take care of the people who caused his defeat. Granted, it was Achan's sin, but Joshua still suffered a defeat at the hands of this king. And we see that his hand giving us victory in an area in which we suffered a previous defeat encourages us, making us realize that, oh, okay, God's with me. His presence is revealed not because we've tried some new tactics or we have reinforcements, but because we have set things right with God. We have given that defeat over to God, and now God is fighting for us. But wait, there's more to this. Look at how God does this for Joshua. When I realized this was just as overwhelming. Coming from a leader and how leaders deal with defeat and failure and how the weight of that failure must have just been pressing on Joshua. What does he say to Joshua? "Raise your javelin." When was the last time God told a leader to raise something in the midst of a battle with who? Moses. He told Moses to raise that he needed to raise the staff. And remember, in that story, the two guys had to come alongside and hold up the arms. He's doing the same thing. Do you think Joshua, that's all coming back to Joshua's mind right now? "Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you." Everything is going back to normal. God's presence is revealed in Joshua, just like it was with Moses. It's amazing. What's interesting about that story, with Moses, right? And when he rose, when he was raised in his arms and they defeated, Joshua was in that battle. Joshua witnessed that battle. He was leading the charge in that battle. After that battle, God says to Moses, write this down as a memorial. And he wanted it as a memorial to let them know that God would always be at war with the king of Amalek. But then he says this, and recite it to Joshua. Moses was to recite that battle to Joshua over and over and over again. Do you think that after the defeat, you know, when you come into a ministry position and maybe you're following someone who is just like a Moses, they're just great, and you're like, man alive, and Joshua had to hear that story over and over and over again, which represented God's power and how God's power can be used through certain people, right? And he hears that story, and you see those stories, and you're like, man, I just wish God's power can be manifested in my life like that. And then you suffer a defeat, and you're like, oh, it's just never going to be like that at all. God's never going to show himself powerful like he did with Moses. And here, after all of that, God tells Joshua to do what? Raise your javelin. Joshua knew exactly what this meant. He knew that it meant God was fighting for him. And we're not sure if Joshua was told to keep it up, but we know that he does, because you know he's like, I ain't ever putting this thing down. Tears are streaming. He's like, man, God is working in my life the same way he was working in Moses' life, even after that defeat. He's crying, he's holding that javelin, and he doesn't put it down until that entire work is finished. Because he doesn't want to lose that presence ever, ever, ever again. We can look at all the details of this battle. And it was a great battle. And it shows Joshua what it's like when God's presence is back with him. But look at how God is encouraging Joshua and Israel. What a gracious God we have. To allow him to do the same thing his predecessor did is absolutely amazing. Moses failed. Paul failed. Peter failed. We all fail. We all suffer defeats. But God remains the same. And he's in the business of moving us past those defeats and using us in mighty ways, just like those who have gone before us. Microsoft has formally launched the final revision of its Windows operating system for PCs. It's called Windows Me, short for Windows Millennial Edition. One of the features of Windows Me that has caused a new stir is the System Restore feature. How does it work? Suppose you suffer a system crash on your computer this Thursday. You're not a computer expert and you don't know how to recover the last 2 weeks of financial information you entered Wednesday or your daughter's history report that she started on Monday. All you have to do is select System Restore and specify the date to which you want the machine to reset. Voila, problem solved. All the things you somehow messed up are put back in their configuration as of that of the earlier day. God hits the System Restore button with Joshua. He brings them back to where they left off, moving them beyond that defeat. He moves us beyond our dismaying defeats with his encouraging victories. He gives them a victory. Gives them a victory at the hands of those in which they suffered the defeat from. Moving them past that. When And look how the story ends there. They take the king, and then they bury him in what? A heap of stones. Who was the last person to be buried in a heap of stones? Achan. The defeat is over. God moves them beyond it. He does so by restoring them to his purposes, redeeming that defeat and revealing his presence. System restored. Father, thank you for how you operate in our lives. Thank you that defeats in your eyes can be used for your victories. When we follow you, when our hearts are turned to you, and when we walk in obedience, we know that you are a God who redeems those things, not for our glory, but for yours. We ask that you do those things in our lives. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.